This is Jim Shirtcliffe, recorded at his home in Gallywood, Chelmsford, by Chris Alden Lee on the 16th of October 2009. Jim Shirtcliffe, Part 2.
Let's talk about your winter at Fossil Bluff next, if we may, which was with Brian Taylor, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yeah.
Again, this was Johnny Green who interceded here.
Yes.
Did he want to go to Fossil Bluff, and if so, why?
No, I didn't want to go. I knew it was there. We were working at Adelaide, or should I say I was working at Adelaide, and we were putting some new huts up. They were these prefabricated variety 8-foot by 4-foot panels that were already made and you just lift into place. It was really quite an interesting job. And Johnny was obviously planning ahead, wanting somebody to go into Fossil Bluff to make up the number. And he just said, have you got your bags packed? something like that. And I said, why? What's in the offing? And he said, I'd like you to fly to Fossil Bluff. The aircraft are up there on the Piedmont, and I was saying, really? Yeah. And he said, you want it? How do you feel about that? And I said, yes, all right. What would my position be at Fossil Bluff? And he said, as a GA. And I said, as a GA, just as a GA, working with scientists and working in the field. And he said, mostly in the summer, and you'll probably get yourself a dog team. And I said, oh, right, yeah, I could be interested. And he said, right, well, tomorrow morning or something like that, as quick as that, the aircraft, you know, the first opportunity, you're off to the bluff then, down tools and everything. And I said, yeah, wow, can't take all my baggage, can I? And he said, what you can get in the aircraft, you can take with you. So I had to jettison some things. I never got them back. No, I don't know. I don't know where they are. They're still in Adelaide somewhere. But I went to Fossil Bluff, and I met Brian and Sam and Rod Walker. Brian, excellent fellow.
Brian Taylor,
a geologist and paleontology, excellent fellow, and a good worker. He was the most amazing person because. He could get through a pair of boots in a couple of months in the summer. He wore through more pairs of boots than anybody that I ever come across. I think it must be something to do with the terrain there. But when he worked in the field, he was meticulous as well as industrious, very industrious. And Ben Hodges, who you mentioned earlier, asked me at that time, could he work with Brian as his general assistant? And I said, well, of course you can. Yeah, in fact, we welcome it. You know, if anybody says, I would prefer to do this, you just like Ralph Horne when he was in the field and George McLeod said, I wouldn't mind working with Ralph. We can row along together quite well. Sam Blake was an unusual person, Fossil Bluff. He was Irishman. And he was, I suppose you could say, deeply religious in many ways. He wasn't one that prayed aloud and get under your skin, but he was a practicing Christian. You know, you didn't have too many obligations, and there were not too many rules. And what he liked about the Catholics was that they did have dogmas where you had to do this and you had to give up some of your time or some of your money for the church and to the poor and to the needy and you help people when you see them in difficulties and so on. Now, Sam Blake used to sit on his bunk, and he was on the bunk above me, and when I was on gash hand, which was cooking the food and topping up the tanks and doing the various chores at Fossil Bluff, Sam couldn't just sit on his bed and read the Bible and watch you. He had to jump down and go and get some snow and for the top up the tanks. And he said, "Don't you bother about taking the rubbish out. I'll do that for you." And, you know, he'd make you feel as though you were under a little obligation to him in a way, that he would get down off his bunk when he saw that you were doing what was your duty, and he'd help you to do it. And in exchange, you had to think, well, I must do the same for him. You know, when it's his turn on, I shall have to reciprocate. And he was an extraordinary fellow.
How was morale in the huts that winter?
Quite good.
Any little gaps? Any cracks appear?
I don't think so. Now, if somebody said otherwise, then they'd have to point it out to me. Perhaps I was too busy in myself looking at what goes on.
You were very busy because you were fixing muskegs and trying to sort out generators, weren't you?
Yeah, yes, all sorts of things, yeah.
What was the problem with the generator?
Me. The problem with the generator was me. Right. Right. The generator was on a little lean-to to the house, or to the hut. And it got damn cold overnight, and it got so cold that you couldn't crank the handle to start it. And so what I used to do, used to take a blow lamp in there and leave the blow lamp roaring away and to warm it up. And frost used to form on the crankcase of this machine, and you'd watch the frost gradually go down to the bottom. When it got down to the bottom, you could crank up and start the jenny. Well, what happened on one occasion is that the blow lamp fell over and burnt off one of the cushy foot mountings under the machine on one, and it had four cushy foot mountings, and so I'd burnt through one of them, and of course you can't just go round the corner and get another one. And I know you've got to be resourceful as a FID, so my resourcefulness was solely stretched at this stage, because I had to find material as well as this kind of technology to make a cushy foot mountain. To
is this a rubber pad or some sort of
yes thing? Yeah, and you see, you know, scientifically, if your absorption and the vibration are kind of in harmony with each other, that the problems kind of are modified. They don't disappear, but they're modified. Yeah, that was it. I felt.
What was your solution?
I had to get one or two erasers, rubbers, and glue them in to this aluminium mounting. And it's funny, you know, but when you're at Fossil Bluff, things like that become extremely important, that cushy mountain, we do need one, you know, first effort, I must get one. So I got on the radio to Brian Bowler at Stonington and said, have you heard of them? Yes, of course I have, yeah. Right, I said, well, have you got one? Spare? I said, you know, we're urgent, it's very urgent, we need it, one or two, desperately, at Fossil Bluff. So when you come down, bring a couple with you. And he didn't. He didn't know what I was talking about. And he says, oh, there's only a spring or something like that, isn't it, under the machine? I didn't. Oh, no. It's much more complicated than that.
So did the engine erasers work?
Yes. Yeah, it did work. I don't know how well or whether it carried on working that way and whether the next person, although we did indent for some new cushy foot mountings, so hopefully they were all replaced.
I've got the base log for that period, and there's a lovely description in June of going outside to see the moonlight.
Oh.
According to the log, there were times when the moonlight was brighter than the daylight.
Yes. Yeah, amazing.
Describe it to me.
Sam Blake said to me on one occasion, come and have a look at this. And we went outside. Oh, I don't know when it was, but just above the mountains there was this huge full moon. And I couldn't believe it looked so unnatural. Apart from anything else, it looked to be bigger than it normally is. And so we stood there admiring this thing and its kind of weird orangey colour. And it's I've never experienced it before. If I can break away just from Fossil Bluff a bit and go back to Argentine Islands. When I was working at the Argentine Islands, I went out the new door, which was the far end of the hut, and it was extremely early in the morning, about 4 o'clock, and I knew the sun wasn't coming up or anything like that. And I looked in the sky, and there was some noctilucent cloud. Now, noctilucent cloud isn't just water vapour up there. It's particles of something like the dust or whatever, really way up there, miles and miles high. So I said to the Met man who was awake at the time, Gallagher, and I said, Alec, you know, have you seen this? And so he wandered down and had a look. He was a 2-year. He's just doing his second year, Alec Gallagher, and he suffered with loss of sleep. And I said, look at that. What do you make of that? And as we were watching it, it went from pink to grey and disappeared altogether, and the sun started to come up. And I said, what do you reckon to that? And he said, noctilucent cloud. I said, you've seen it before? And he said, no. I said, well, you don't seem to be all that excited. No, no, he says, I know it's there. It's just you can't see it most of the time. And it's like this moon. You know, Sam and I were standing looking at this, and I said, this is really amazing, isn't it? You know, how do you capture this? Can you picture it? Can you paint it or photograph it? People won't believe this.
So it was large, it was orangey.
Large and orangey, yeah.
High or low?
Low, just breaking just above the mountains on the other side.
Could you see the topography on the moon's surface? It's difficult to remember.
It is difficult to remember.
There's mention of mock moons and moon pillars.
Oh, yes. Sun pillars, moon pillars, yeah.
What are they?
Right. When you get Cirrostratus is the most amazing thing. Cirrostratus is a cloud made up of ice particles in suspension. And, of course, as the winter wears on and the temperature on the surface goes down to minus 30, minus 40, these little ice particles are at the surface. So, you know, you're walking amongst them, and they call it diamond dust. And if you look towards the sun, oh, yes, certainly if you are on a hill, if you look towards the sun, where you know where the sun is, immediately to the left and to the right, and sometimes immediately above, you get these very bright and coloured spots as well. And sometimes, which is rare, there's an arc that links them up over the top as well. We witnessed that at Fossil Bluff. Brian Taylor in particular was very enthusiastic about these phenomena, and very observant as well.
They couldn't be. Could they be photographed or not?
They can be. The photograph doesn't do it justice, really. It's kind of awe-inspiring in a way, where you see this and think, and it's only brief. Mm. And that's the whole thing about it, is you say, oh, I'll go and get a friend and bring him, let him have a look. You can't, because all the time it's changing, and yeah, when the cloud changes, it disappears, and you say, well, it's like the noctilucent cloud. Alex said, well, I know they're there all the time. And I said, well, that is the first time I've ever seen noctilucent cloud. And it was, first of all, you know, quite high up, whitish, going pinkish, and then greyish and disappearing.
You had a skiing accident, according
to
this.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Serious?
Didn't break anything, but it was a skiing accident. We were doing some practice at Fossil Bluff, and, yeah, it's foolish, isn't it? I fell over and ripped an ankle. No, it was the bones in my foot, wasn't it? The metacarpals on the top of the foot. Mm. It all swelled up, but it was a matter of time. Like all things, the body repairs itself, given.
And there's quite a nice description of a particularly bad hurricane in October.
Yes.
This is the one where they bombard the roof with gravels and stones.
Yes.
Was that a worrying time?
Certainly was. Who wrote this in there? Was that,
well, I don't know.
Brian Taylor, was it?
It doesn't say who wrote the log.
No, but it was that when it blew. Right, well, yeah, I always thought that, wind tends to funnel down certain places, like through the col and down valleys. And Brian Bowler had experienced this when he came down from Stonington with the muskegs, that in certain places you could be lying up for day after day thinking that everybody's getting a gale of wind, whereas in actual fact it's very localised, just where you happen to be. Mm. And we went down to, I think it was the Waitabit Cliffs from Fossil Bluff, and did we have the muskeg at the time? I think we had the muskeg down there. And I had to, out of presence of mind, I decided to put the muskeg on the windward side of the tent on the off chance that it would, you could tie the guy to the muskeg, because it's not going to blow that away, and that it would break the wind a bit. But scary. When you reckon that the wind is strong enough to blow stones at you, it's pretty damn strong.
Let's talk about this terrific trip you made then from Adelaide Island to Fossil Bluff. You trained the dogs up for this.
Yes.
This was in the...
From Adelaide to Fossil Bluff, 62, yes.
62, I think this was.
Yeah, right. Well, I...
63.
63, okay. My... yes, I kept my team at Adelaide with... I think there were two or three other teams. And they were great. They were a great team, called the Players. And I had this belief that if you didn't take them out daily or alternate days, that they would, just like people, physically, you know, your muscles would lose their tone. So I used to pop my head out and shout, "Hello, boys!" And they'd all stand up and wag their tails, and you knew that they just knew they liked to go for a run. And once you started putting the harnesses on, they got so excited. Oh, dear, they got so excited they were almost couldn't contain them. And so I started taking runs out from Adelaide, sometimes over the sea ice and sometimes even further afield. And on one occasion I took the tent and sleeping bag and some food and, you know, rations and some pots and pans box and some fuel. And I thought, you know, if the worst comes to the worst, I can always camp and then get back to base the following day or whatever. And so I headed off from Adelaide and towards an island called the Dions. And I could see it in the distance, and I thought, I'll head towards the Dions today, and then, you know, when I've done so much time, I can turn around and go back, you see. And then when I'd done me so much time, I thought, good God, you know, I reckon I could make the Dions. And so I got there and went on to the Dions and took the dogs. And, of course, there were some emperor penguins there. And I didn't expect that. And these emperor penguins were standing in the gully. And so I thought, I'll take a picture of those and get my camera out. A buddy camera wouldn't work. It was frozen. And so I couldn't get a picture of anything. So I stuck it back inside and zipped up and thought, well, I'll tell them on base. I'll tell Harry Leckie, the base leader, when I get back. And so I then headed back for base. and it started to get quite dark and started to get quite late before I got back, because I could see the light on the hut. So I went back from the Dion's and stuck the dogs back in the span and fed them and went up to the hut. And I saw Harry Leckie, and Harry was the base leader and was a Met man. And he said, I said, you would not believe this, but I went to the Dion's this afternoon. Bloody rubbish. He said, bloody rubbish. He said, all right then, he says, describe it to me. And I said, all right. And it, you know, it's quite small, sort of gully and a big pinnacle rock here, and right in the middle there, you've got a dozen emperor penguins nesting down on. And he said, that's right. And he said, it's not everybody that knows that there's emperor penguins on the Dion's. And I said, well, I do now. And the following day, he got Fred Gibbs to harness up his team, and he went there and took a few photos and came back. So I said, right, there we are. You know, I did it. Single-handed, because you did it as well.
And all this is preparation for the big trip?
This is all preparation for the big trip.
Now, I've got the account of that here as well. What I find interesting is this emerged because you decided to go ahead and do this because the two aircraft had been damaged, so you couldn't fly there.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yes. And we got no air support, and we couldn't get back out until they repaired the aircraft. The other thing was we could sledge all the way back out. I wasn't really looking forward to the return journey. Summer sea ice over that piece by the Dion's, which they'd already lost three people, hadn't they?
Yeah. This is a 25-day journey.
Yeah.
So what were your travel tactics? What was the plan?
We didn't really have a plan. Except, anyway, what we did, when we got on the sea ice, OK... I'm usually safety first. We got to Marguerite Bay in record time. I think we got to Marguerite Bay in next to no time. Then following day, we hitched up and headed from Marguerite Bay to Fossil Bluff. We could see part of as we looked down, you could see the mountains, and you thought, that's Adelaide Island, and there's the mainland. That's what we're heading for. And from 300 miles, you could see the Batterby Range. And he thought, right, well, if I sort of head that direction, we'll get, you know, when we get closer, we'll recognise the landmarks and we'll head straight for it. We had a scary moment. Yeah, he said, yes, a scary moment. Yeah, one scary moment, because it was tough going with the sledges we were all loaded up. And you had to think about how many miles could you make a day. I'm not into records. I don't set out to break records. But when we set out that way, I kept saying, yeah, wouldn't it be a good idea to have a big sail up and the following wind and blow you there and just let the dogs trot? And on one occasion, as we got over the barrier, I think we were either approaching the barrier or over the barrier, we had a following wind, and it was blowing snow along the surface, and then it got worse and worse and then worse. And so we had a little confab, and I said, George McLeod took his team, one, was it Ivor Morgan and me, but George McLeod, and you know, the three of us had a little confab and said, well, you know, this is fantastic. We've got a following wind and everything's driving us towards the bluff. Shall we keep going or shall we pitch tent for the day? And the general opinion was we'll keep going, go as far as we can, and then we'll pitch tents. But, of course, the loss of visibility, lost contact with the others. So we went on, turned round and came back again, thinking that we'd meet the others, but we didn't. So we pitched the tent and spent the night. George McLeod hadn't got a tent. He'd got his team. He hadn't got a tent. I think he'd got his sleeping bag. And so the following day, he got up and the wind had dropped and the visibility was amazing. And we were looking around, and every little spot got the binoculars on and said, "Is that George McLeod?" "No, is that George McLeod?" And eventually we located him and said, that's George McLeod. And he was sort of stationary or heading for the bluff. So we headed in that direction, and he became stationary. And we said, "Oh, it is George McLeod." So we headed towards him, and eventually we met up and said, "Oh, God, how did you spend the night?" And he said, "I got in my sleeping bag and sat alongside the sledge on its side or something like that." And I said, "Christ, you must be exhausted. What about, you know, pitch the tent now. We'll pitch the tent now and you can get in and doss down." And he said, "No, I'm all right. I'm okay." And I said, "Well, we will anyway. We'll make you a cup of tea and give you a bite to eat. And thank heavens we haven't lost you, because we could have got separated." And at that stage, how far were we from the bluff? Must have been 100 miles from the bluff. And, yes, fortunately, I've forgotten the detail of how I kept contact with the team immediately behind me, but George must have passed me somehow. And when I turned around and went back, I missed him, but I met the others. And we, when day dawned, I just thought, you don't have to make many mistakes down here before you get a catastrophe. It's a bit like with Bro, one sort of a little mistake and not too long you're in.
Going into this, when the storm abated, you discovered that you're only 100 yards from the other tent. But McLeod, of course, was not to be seen.
No. Oh, the 100 yards from the other tent? Yeah, we didn't meet up with them then. Well, that was luck. That was sheer luck. Yes. Yeah, they decided
to count 100 yards apart, not knowing you, where the one was.
So it could have been a catastrophe.
McLeod had built a shelter for himself, centred around with ice blocks, centred around the other sledge.
Yeah. And he just sat in his sleeping bag or whatever.
He made a roof of snow blocks set on skis and ski sticks. And a bi-halogen lamp was lit to provide heat.
Yeah. Yeah. George McLeod is one of the most resourceful people. He's amazing.
Clearly. Were you frightened then?
Oh, not so much frightened as worried about reputations. Mm. Because, when you think, if we'd lost George altogether, I would feel pretty bad about it. And then Johnny Green would have known about it, even if he ever never spoke to you about it. And the rest of the staff...
Persistent problems seem to be coming up against pressurise, I presume.
Yeah.
Ridges of pressurise, where the ice has been pressured into rising.
Yes.
Did he have any particular way of getting around that problem, or was it?
No, not particularly. It's just it makes life a bit harder. The pressure is not immense. You're only looking at sort of up to 12 feet sometimes. I was talking to Ivor Morgan one day, when we'd stopped and pegged the teams, and he was standing, still had his skis on. And I was talking to him, and he disappeared. Fell down a hole about 3 or 4 metres down below me as he was talking. We could have both gone down there.
He fell into the water, didn't he?
No, he just went down into this crevasse, and he still had his skis on when he hit the bottom. And I thought, crikey. amazing.
He fell into a thinly bridged gap into water and slush.
Who did?
Morgan.
No slush, no water. No. Is that what it says?
Fortunately, we were carrying a climbing rope, and I guess you were able to get him out.
Yeah, no, he was almost able to get himself out.
Oh, well, okay.
I didn't think there was any water there.
Well, this is what that base report says.
Yeah.
When you got there, mm-hmm. what was it like to arrive? Were they glad to see you?
There was nobody there.
Oh, right.
It was empty, Fossil Bluff. We were the staff. Yeah, it was... it's amazing in a way, because you get to Fossil Bluff and you think, right, this place has been standing there now for 6 months unoccupied or longer unoccupied, and here we are, ready to do the work, and the aircraft have been damaged, and so we hadn't got any... Really, you're on your own devices. So I think Ralph Horne was with us, wasn't he, at this stage? And Ralph was going to go and do some geology. And George McLeod said, I'll be his outside man, his GA.